Merci, Monsieur le Président, de cette introduction et de cette synthèse excellente de mes idées. Je dois dire, je suis très content d'être ici. J'aurais pu donner tout le discours en français, mais j'ai mes instructions, et mes instructions sont très claires que je dois parler dans ma langue natale. Alors. It's, of course, for an author always a great pleasure to come into a room walking past a very substantial pile of one's own books. I am tonight not going to relieve you of the dubious responsibility of actually reading them by giving you a full account of their contents, but I will say a word at the beginning about La Grande Crise, the end of normal, which is an attempt to provide a synthesis of the of the confluence of ideas and circumstances that led to the great financial crisis in 2007-2009, but also to talk about the way in which that crisis represented a change or marked a change in more fundamental circumstances or underlying circumstances in the global economy, which to my mind is something that we need to which we need to adjust our thinking in order to have appropriate policy responses going forward. This is an argument which I think is of global scope. It really operates at the level of the world economy as a whole and deals with such questions as the energy and environmental situation and the global security situation, effects of the digital revolution, and of the general decay of modern financial systems. But it's an argument which has, I think, touched a substantially more responsive or receptive chord in European audiences than is the case in the United States. And that may be simply because European audiences are more flexible and have greater capacity to change their minds on questions, but it may also be because the American audience has been accustomed for a much longer time to the general idea that, as Bismarck said, God protects drunks, fools in the United States of America, and things will always be on an upward path. So I find myself, to a certain degree, Europeanized and acquiring some of the habits of pessimism and realistic cynicism which have long characterized the intellectual tradition on this continent. That said, I speak still as an outside observer and quite conscious of the limits of my engagement with the fate and future of Europe. But some matter to which I've been devoting a considerable amount of attention over quite a few years, and this year in particular, I enjoyed the very interesting privilege of assisting for 5 months the finance minister of the Hellenic Republic, my friend and my teaching colleague at the University of Texas, Yanis Varoufakis, during his tenure in that position. And my perspective on European questions was, shall we say, enriched by that experience. And what I want to do this evening particularly is to talk a little bit about that and to give you at least some, let's say, some cause for reflection on a particular aspect of the Great Crisis, a particular aspect which is of, I think, universal concern for the citizens of modern democracies, which is the relationship between financial power and a democratic potential. That's something for which I think the Greek experience lends, on which the Greek experience lends a good deal of clarity at the present time. So the underlying principle, okay, to illustrate it, let me give you just a small example. You may recall that back in May of 2014, there was an election for the European Parliament, during which the then incumbent Prime Minister of the Grand Duchy of Luxembourg stood for the presidency of the European Commission. And he won the election. Yet there was a question in the days immediately following as to whether he would actually accede to the position. And I can report that I played a small role in advancing the cause of democracy in this matter, because I spent election night at the headquarters of the party of the opposition in Greece, the coalition of the parties of the radical left, Syriza. And 2 days later, I had lunch, a private lunch, with a young man who was in charge of that party, which had emerged as the largest party in Greece in that election. The fellow was a guy by the name of Alexis Tsipras. And at lunch, Alexis said that he thought it would be a good idea if, having won the election, on democratic principle, if Prime Minister Juncker acceded to the position, and thought perhaps he should be the first European leader to make this case. And I thought this was a good idea, and I offered to draft the press release making the argument, which I did, and which they released a few hours before Chancellor Merkel changed her position on the matter. It's perhaps a dubious, you may say, achievement, but to the extent that it helped it's a political transition in Luxembourg, I'm proud to have been associated with it. The precedent, therefore, was a simple one, which is that elections should have consequences. They should, that a functioning political process should not be entirely indifferent to the outcome of a free and fair ballot. So with that in mind, let's review the drama that unfolded in Greece. And we have to go back quite a few years just to set the background. It is very clear that this was never a country which was well governed from an economic standpoint. Nobody maintains that it was. It was admitted to the euro in the first place under false premises and for political rather than the established or economic reasons. And in the first decade during which the euro was in effect in Greece, the combination of interest rate convergence and the elimination of exchange rate risk fostered a very substantial increase in the borrowing of the state, as it did in private sector borrowing and other parts of the European periphery, and in Greece it was for the most part the public sector, and in most cases for projects which included military equipment, German tanks and submarines, French aircraft, infrastructure projects, the Olympic Games, and also covering hidden deficits in such parts of the social structure as the healthcare system. Debts that could not be and were never expected to be repayable on commercial terms, essentially added to the future tax burden of the Greek state. That debt was therefore predicated on an assumed growth in income and tax capacity over time to the extent that it was justified at all, and there was a great extent to which it was not justified, but simply the product of entirely questionable processes between the lenders who took risks knowing or expecting that they would be rescued from the consequences of that, and borrowers who took out loans, perhaps with the inducement of financial incentives on the side. In any event, as the process unfolded, the very capacity, even in principle, to meet the payments was undermined by the rising unit costs, the rising wage levels and unit costs of the Greek private sector. leaving the entire economy exposed. And in 2010, it was the entirely predictable victim of the world financial crisis, insofar as the world investment community fled from assets that were risky toward assets that were safe, and the private credit markets collapsed for the Greek state. So at that point, faced with an undoubted financial crisis, what Europe, joined by the International Monetary Fund, actually did, and in the case of the IMF, the reasons that it joined in the enterprise reflect very poorly on the governance of that institution. What they did was to commit what would be considered by financial regulators, certainly in their period of proper responsibility in the United States, was to commit a financial crime. And the crime was to knowingly extend a vast new loan to a bankrupt, to an entity that was known could not meet the terms of the loan. Rather than write down the failed loans and work through a process of resolution of and recapitalization of the institutions that had made those loans, Europe and the International Monetary Fund, and it has to be said, under the urging of the government of the United States, the Secretary of the Treasury, Timothy Geithner, who was very concerned about the exposure of American banks, particularly through derivative instruments, credit default swaps situation, extended a vast new loan to Greece. Hide the previous losses, to clear the debt from the books of the private banking system and place them instead on the backs of the, on the shoulders of the taxpayers of Europe, including from numerous countries that are considerably less wealthy than Greece. The IMF's reason for participating in this was twofold. One was that the IMF was otherwise practically out of business. Latin American countries, for example, had ceased dealing with it. And the other was, of course, that the managing director of the IMF was an ambitious figure who wished to become president of the Republic of France and had in mind the effect of this on his standing with the French banking sector. The European Central Bank contributed its own highly questionable practice by buying up the bonds of the Greek banks from the of the Greek state from the private sector at a deep discount through the securities market program, the SMP, and then expecting that the Greek state would service those bonds in full. Greece was, as a consequence of these maneuvers, placed under the memorandum, the original memorandum of understanding, which dictated policy terms that it would have to comply with in order to be a participant in this particular financial transaction. The economists in the IMF and elsewhere joined in over internal protests and protests from some of the other directors of the IMF in predicting that the whole package, which would inevitably be recessionary, nobody questioned that, would yield a recession of about 5%, a loss of 5%, serious but not catastrophic, in Greek GDP, followed by a recovery over a few years, fully recovered by 2013. Instead, as everyone knows, the Greek economy collapsed, went down by about 25%, and it did not recover at all. In 2012, there was a partial write-down of the debts, which strongly affected the Greek pension funds and undermined the financial stability of the Greek pension system. In 2014, there was a mirage of growth, often cited in the press, but which in fact consisted of the fact that prices were falling more rapidly than nominal GDP. Both numbers were going down. So although real GDP, whatever that is, was ostensibly increasing, if you were in debt in this situation, you were in effect in debt deflation, which meant that the burden of the debt was getting heavier as time went on. And it was that factor, along with the fact that the recovery of the economy was utterly invisible to the Greek public, that propelled the political events of late last year and early this year. Now, under this kind of economic stress, democratic governments don't tend to fare very well. And three Greek governments collapsed under the memorandum, that George Papandreou, that of Lucas Papademos, and then finally in December, that of Antonios Samaras. And in late 2014, what the left opposition succeeded in doing was to provoke an election for late January, for which the incumbents prepared the ground in several interesting ways. There were major principal payments that were due in March and on into June to the IMF, and July and August into to the IMF and the ECB, which any government in its right mind would have looked at and said, I don't want to be in power when these come due because they can't be met. In addition to that, the government was offered a six-month extension of the program, accepted two, with the effect any new government would have a very short deadline to reach a agreement on a program extension. German finance ministry, amongst others, German finance minister made clear his view that the elections should not be permitted to change policy. Elections should change nothing. When the elections in fact occurred, the Greek government was formed, the chairman of the Eurogroup went directly to Athens and restated that position with the additional threat that if the memorandum was not adhered to, the Greek banking system would be made to collapse. Nevertheless, the result was solid. A government was formed with a very strong popular backing. It rose to 80% in early February, and negotiations began. Now, the victory of the left in Greece, now this was a true left, this was a coalition of parties that had never before held power, what had been prepared in part by a body of ideas for which Yanis Varoufakis held principal responsibility, and they are expressed in this little volume that's available here, Proposition Modeste pour résoudre la crise de la zone euro, which I was invited to help co-author the final version. Very kindly, Michel Rocard provides a preface for the French edition. This was not necessarily the letter, chapter and verse of the Syriza program, but it expressed the spirit of the Greek approach to the European problem, which was to try to resolve these questions at the level of Europe and within the context and framework of the European Charters and Treaties. It was and remains a Europeanist approach. It included 4 points, all of which were rather carefully and one might say technically drafted to abide within the existing legal framework. The first having to do with using the good offices of the European Central Bank to effect a mutualization of debts up to the Maastricht compliant limits, the 60% of GDP, so as to provide a foundation for any state that wished to participate in essentially very manageable access to credit, which would then make the excess debt, the debt that exceeded the Maastricht limits, much more manageable than it otherwise would be. Second had to do with bringing the resolution of failed banks on a case-by-case basis up to the European level in a way which would break a toxic political relationship between bankrupt banks and bankrupt states, and therefore relieve some of the pressure on states to follow particular policy prescriptions because they can't afford and couldn't afford to meet the burden of replacing insuring deposits without exiting from the euro. The third was an investment program to begin the process of restarting economic growth and using the European Investment Bank and European Investment Fund as the agents of design and technical assistance, a way in part of moving that process, first of all, financing it, but secondly, of moving the technical management of that process into hands that were practiced and that could overcome the very weakened capabilities of the states, of some of the states in the European periphery. And the fourth, which was my contribution actually, was the idea of a program to fund direct assistance to households, the most vulnerable households mainly in the vulnerable countries, but in fact it could be anywhere, in the form of nutrition assistance or unemployment insurance, to begin a process, in other words, of direct extension of solidarity to the continental level, with the idea that this would have the effect of stabilizing incomes, as well as a political and psychological effect of giving people whose links to the European project were increasingly tenuous some reason to believe that there would be a possibility of progress. This was modeled on the food stamp program in the United States, in fact, and in the early months of the Greek government, a program of this kind was enacted at the national level. None of this ever reached the negotiating table. It was a set of ideas which expressed a willingness to address problems in a comprehensive way, but that was far beyond either the practical capability, the ambition of the Greek government that came into place, and certainly beyond what was permitted, would have been permitted to it. The demands and pressures on that government were entirely more limited. And what the negotiations turned on instead were the points of policy within the existing program, within the framework of the memorandum, where there had been particular reasons on the Greek side to believe that what was being implemented in Greece was dysfunctional, was contributing and exacerbating rather than relieving the crisis. And here there were four elements which I'm sure you're familiar with. I'll give them back to you very, very briefly. They had to do, first of all, with the organization of labor markets, where collective bargaining, not all that extensive in Greece in the best of times, but a basic principle of progressive government, had been substantially dismantled under the memorandum. And the proposition offered by the Greek government was that the standards for labor market organization ought to be at least those endorsed by the International Labor Organization and consistent with what is available to other countries in Europe, that Greece should not be the subject of a unique radical experiment in the idea that the labor market uniquely should be disorganized and workers uniquely disempowered with respect by comparison with employers. Second point was a social point, really. It had to do with pensions. Pensions in Greece are a large share of GDP, but they don't provide high incomes. The median pension is about 660 euro a month, 1 euro above the poverty line. And there are a great many people who are getting in the order of 350. And the memorandum was proposing that they be cut by 120. This is pushing people into destitution. People who are already nearly destitute, or destitute, in fact, into deep destitution. And the government was not prepared to agree to it for very concrete social and humanitarian reasons. Third piece had to do with privatizations. This was a left-wing government, as I said, authentically left-wing government, largely composed of people who had once been communists. It was politically disciplined, but it did not choose to oppose the privatization of Greek state assets on principle, and it did not choose to obstruct the privatization. It went right ahead, for example, with the privatization of the port of Piraeus. What they proposed instead was that the privatizations not be done in an economically irrational way by putting all the assets on the auction block at once, with the very predictable result, as any economist will tell you, or anybody who's taken an economics class can tell you, you dump all the supply on the market at once, the price goes not down. And the fact was that was what had happened, and that the buyers, knowing that they could get the assets for cheap, were offering very low prices. And the state was getting no essential, very, very minimal realization. and therefore far from meeting the projections of financial returns from privatization. So the idea was that this would be done on a phased basis with continued participation by the state joint venture equity participations in such a way as to provide an upside if there eventually was one. And the fourth point had to do with the macro basis, which was had to do with the target for the primary surplus, which had implications, of course, for the future restructuring of the debt. Once you agree to a completely unrealistic primary surplus, 4.5%, which nobody defended, was the number in the memorandum, then, first of all, you've set yourself up on a path of failure, and it can always be the case that in 6 months or a year at every review, you will have to take ever more severe steps, even deeper austerity, in order to meet the unattainable target, which then basically locks you into a downward spiral. But beyond that, if you have a reasonable primary surplus target, if it's basically close to zero, a little bit on the positive side, while you are not escaping from austerity entirely, you've relaxed it a bit, you have a little bit more fiscal space, and on top of that, you have set the stage for a proper renegotiation of the debt. Once you have a primary surplus in place, a large target, it can be said, well, you're going to be pulling in the money you can pay. And you're making an unrealistic premise as the foundation for a discussion of the debt, a discussion which has also never actually happened. There were other points of contention, including VAT rates and so forth. But in all of these cases, it's fair to say that on the side of the Greek government, inexperienced though it was, you had a body of local knowledge, a body of recent experience, and a genuine concern with what would happen to the economy of the country. This was not true on the side of the creditors. The creditors had been in the country. They had been living practically in the ministries of the Greek government, giving instructions. But their foundation of their policy wasn't from the country. It had to do with their larger economic formation, with the basic prescriptions that the IMF gives out to everybody, and with a concern that they had for preserving and maintaining institutional power in this relationship. So the negotiations went on. There were moments over this period when the Greek team felt that they might be making some progress. They felt that way on the 20th of February when they got an extension of the program. They felt that way at a few other moments on certain points. But the fact is, through this process, they were dealing with institutions that were not prepared institutionally, politically, to make any concessions at all. At the level of the creditor institutions, I think it's fair to say that the officials with whom the governments were dealing were not empowered by their own superiors to negotiate in a, a good faith way, in a way where concessions come from both sides, you fill out a part of the agenda and then move on to the next one. At the level of the Eurogroup, you had a situation where the primary concerns of the other 18 ministers had to do with their, naturally enough, with their own countries and their own political situations. It's true in the East. Their ideology and commitment is to the neoliberal model per se. It was true in Spain, Portugal, to some degree Ireland, where the problem was a rising left-wing opposition and the unwillingness of the government to make concessions that might undermine its political position at home. Neither of these had anything to do with Greece. The Greeks tried firmness, they tried the Varoufakis approach, and they tried conciliation, which was the Euclid Tsakalotos approach. Nothing came back in either case. Time passed. The government drained $3.5 billion in reserves to keep paying its external debts. It defaulted internally, repeatedly, to suppliers, to its hospitals. It brought in all the reserves from the health system, from the universities, from most municipalities. The European Central Bank played a role of a power role. It kept up a relentless psychological pressure on depositors in the Greek banking system by raising the, first of all, by directing them the banks only to the ELA, and then by raising it bit by bit by bit, in such a way it was always clear that they could stop, and capital controls might be coming at any time. The clock ran down toward the program extension, the bankruptcy of the Greek state, and the loss of collateral value on Greek bonds all at the same time, at the end of June. We knew this was coming. This was not a mystery from February on. That would be when the end game would come. And the only question was, would the German chancellor change her position in order to provide a face-saving solution? Which is something, when you're dealing with her, you know you're not going to get a decision till the last minute, so you had to play out the game. She made her decision. The decision was adverse from the Greek point of view. The sequence that followed, capital controls, the referendum, the escalation of threats that led to the July 12, 13 overnight meeting, capitulation of the Greek government, gave us the present memorandum, €86 billion euro in a new program, and €86 billion of extend and pretend, with all of the terms and conditions that had previously been imposed, and perhaps a few others added in, including the proposition that the Greek government cannot offer acts of legislation to its own parliament unless they've been previously agreed to with the creditors. That's the state of Europe. That's the state of democracy at the present time. In the referendum campaign, every European leader weighed in to pressure the Greek voters with the explicit threat that if they voted no, it would force exit from the euro, which is a political threat, it's an economic reality. In the parliamentary elections that followed, major European leaders, including one familiar to you, made clear that the election could not be considered as bearing on the policies that had just been imposed. And of course, apart from this new party, Popular Unity, which in the end did not make it into parliament, the contest was not between, and you could take the KKE, the communists, and the Nazis as the other examples, the contrast was not between parties. None of the major parties took the position that they was a choice between imposing or not imposing the program, but only between those that did and did not like the program that was going to be imposed. And the Greeks voted for the guys who don't like it. What are the consequences? Let me sort of bring this to back into the larger situation as I, at least as I see it. There are consequences for Greece. It can be called an agreement, it can be called a contract, it can be called a memorandum, but as a legal matter, it seems to me this is a contract executed under duress, under threat. And its legitimacy, if not in a court, at least in a moral sense, can be questioned and will be questioned. It's not going to stand there as something which people are going to kid themselves their government went into good faith confidence that it would succeed. It will, of course, be implemented at the level of parliamentary actions. That's going on now. I'm sure they've been the business right now of passing the bills. But will it be implemented at the level of the magistrates who have to evict people from their homes or close down the private business sector? That, I think, remains to be determined. Countries can't be administered except by their own nationals who have, in the final analysis, that's where the question of what works and what doesn't work will be decided. At first, there may be cooperation. I can't imagine it will continue for very long. Will this succeed in bringing the Greek economy back to economic growth? I could be wrong as an economist. Perhaps the neoliberals are entirely correct, but so far as I can analyze the situation myself, it looks like more of what failed over 5 years, except pressed to a higher degree and very unlikely to produce that result. Will there then eventually be a return to active resistance? It wasn't long ago that Syntagma Square was a battleground. It might become one again quite soon, or in a year or two. And then you have to ask, will this government behave the way the previous government behaved with respect to that kind of protest. I doubt it. So I don't think the situation in Greece is resolved, but we'll have to leave it to the Greeks to determine exactly how this will play out. What about elsewhere? It seems pretty clear that what happened here was a decision to base policy on what is frankly intimidation for political effect, not just in Greece, but in Spain, Portugal, Ireland, elsewhere, France. One has to ask, will that work? The answer to that is possibly, to a degree. Certainly in this round of elections, it's possible. Indefinitely, it would just astonish me. People can be intimidated for a certain period of time, and then they get tired of it. That's what happened in Greece. That's why Syriza won the elections in January. People got tired of being intimidated. They wanted the psychological affirmation of standing up on their own two feet, and boy, they felt great when they did. And I don't think the Italians or the Portuguese or the Spaniards or the Irish are necessarily different psychologically. So there will be resentment, and eventually someplace there will be rebellion. And that rebellion will take one of two forms, it seems to me, depending upon whether the country is large or small. In a large country, in France or in Italy, there's the capacity to do what you want if you want to do it hard enough and are prepared to stand up and do it. And those countries are already carving out considerable space within the European framework, which is why Finance Minister Schäuble has a very strong agenda of trying to impress his ideas upon the French. But what about the small countries? So the large countries can do what they want without leaving the euro, it seems to me. But can the small countries? I think the answer to that is not so likely. Not so likely. So that brings me to one last short discussion with respect to something that I was involved in, which was the famous Plan B. And Plan B, in the Greek context, was a very remote contingency, but it was certainly a contingency plan. It was not a plan that was advanced because the government had any intention of taking the initiative to exit the Eurozone, but because there was the possibility that when the deadline arrived, the government might be forced to take that step. And someone had to do some thinking about what the sort of basic steps of action would have to be in that contingency so as to avoid having to make it up as they went along. That someone was me, along with a few other people, lawyers, financial specialists. We could not speak to Greece's European partners or to the IMF about this, even though there were people who would have been willing to speak to us, including the German finance ministry, with whom the Greek finance ministry had a perfectly cordial and professional relationship, including at the IMF. But we couldn't do it because of the volatility of the subject in Greek and international politics and in the media. So we were very limited in what we could do. I think what we produced was useful, but would have been useful, but also imperfect. This will not be the case the next time. The next time whoever is in this position will come to a negotiating table with a set of ideas about what should be done on one side and a plan B on the other. There will be a door in the ministry with a Plan B office sign on the door. That's how you would proceed. It's going to be known that you have to have that alternative because it will be clear that a negotiation that is purely predicated on not having a Plan B, on staying in the euro, on a commitment to the eurozone and to the euro, is a negotiation in which you have no leverage. So the other approach will be taken next time by small countries. I don't know which one. I imagine possibly Ireland, but I don't know that for a fact. What I do feel confident of is that one cannot leave whole countries in a state of long-term stagnation without eventually sparking from the right or the left a significant political upheaval. If you want to avoid it, what's required here? There's something that goes on in peace processes, it's called confidence building measures. It seems to me that confidence is greatly eroded throughout much of Europe. And if the European project is going to hold together, there's got to be some initiative to rebuild that confidence. I would suggest to some degree along the lines of that fourth element in the modest proposal, which is to say solidarity at the continental level. Something which provides a tangible reason for the peoples of Europe to believe that they are better off in the Union, and for that matter in the Eurozone, than outside. Symbolic reasons and old stories about the peace of the continent will not suffice indefinitely along those lines. Concrete measures should be taken. And there's an argument which says you can't afford to extend solidarity, to extend social democracy in a time of crisis. That the time of crisis is the time to retrench, to tighten your belts, to give up the luxuries of social protection, of old age pensions, of health insurance, of deposit insurance, of nutrition assistance, all of those things. And I would suggest that the experience on both this continent and my own is exactly the opposite. That in a time of crisis is precisely when you need to create and strengthen those institutions and to recognize where there are gaps and to fill them in. Right? Social Security in the United States was enacted in 1935. Deposit insurance was enacted in 1933. This was in the middle of the Great Depression. Minimum wage came in 1935, along with collective bargaining rights. Right? You can say, okay, we began to get Medicare and Medicaid in 1965, slightly different circumstances, that's true. But what we call Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, came in 2010, in the middle of the crisis. Right? That's when you do these things. That's when social democrats, people who believe in solidarity as a value, should be pressing their agenda. They shouldn't be on the defensive. Shouldn't have to be, and they have to be on the defensive to a certain degree, but they should be moving over into a forward posture as the occasion and as the political circumstances permit. And that solidarity, that ability to cushion people from the worst aspects of more difficult conditions, which is what my book, The Grande Crise, End of Normal, is about. It just flies directly in the face of the austerity doctrine, but in a different way from the Keynesians. The Keynesian program is just stimulate, spend, do quantitative easing, let the banks fund themselves at a zero interest rate, which the banks, by the way, like very much. Okay? And you would too if someone was giving you that zero interest rate, but and the government of Luxembourg gets as close to it, I suppose, as any government. But I don't think it's available on a private mortgage. Okay? So one has to be careful about cloaking in Keynesian rhetoric policies which have a very specific direct beneficiary whose interest in them is quite different from that of the larger society, in this case the financial sector. No. What one needs is to have policies which are institutionally designed to stabilize and protect the broad population, the working population, the retired population, the sick, and the healthy. And that permits people, knowing that those protections are there, to take the kind of economic risks which give you a private sector that can function, particularly at the small and medium scale, which is where you need to create jobs in a world in which technology is constantly working to take them away. So that seems to me to be the line of a coherent strategy at the continental level. And what it then permits is something which was taken away in this crisis, clearly taken away, which is for Democratic constituencies to choose leaders who can innovate, who can replace an old and tired ruling oligarchy with fresh people who've never taken bribes and who are prepared to think about the direction of economic development in a way which is long-term, imaginative, socially constructive, and who have the space and the time to do that. Who are not simply permitted, as the case in Greece, to stay in office in order to implement a policy dictated from outside. So diversity here is important. Franklin Roosevelt started the New Deal by saying the important thing is to experiment, and if you fail, try something else. That's what the idea, I think, of a progressive movement should be. It's interesting, the word reform has its origins in economic terms in the Soviet Union in the 60s. And it meant market process and decentralization. And the word then migrated to the governing institutions of neoliberal capitalism, where it means something that's called markets, but in fact a single line of policy with no decentralization at all. I've called it market Stalinism. I think it's not entirely inappropriate. And so if one wants to have market anti-Stalinism, it's not a bad line of approach for, I think, building a broader constituency for the kinds of change that we all need. It's not just in Europe. I talk about the United States, where these same problems manifest themselves in slightly transformed versions. So let's come back to the relationship between democracy and debt, and then I'll wrap up. What is the leverage that the creditors have over the debtors in this situation? It is not so much that a country is deep in debt. There's a wonderful book by a man named James MacDonald, A Free Nation Deep in Debt. Japan is deep in debt, but it is free in these situations. The problem is the concentration of the holding of debt in specifically political hands that cannot, for reasons of their own politics, and their own politics are to a degree democratic as well, I could say fully democratic, but unable to adjust to the requirements of a democratic process more broadly. That's the problem. It's not by accident that democracy itself evolved, not very far from here, in Holland, in England, the Anglo-Dutch financial system, with countries, or take the Italian republics, with countries that placed their debt in the hands of their own citizens rather than in the hands of external financial providers. That's the essence of national independence. It's not by accident that after the First World War, which was financed in the democracies by the massive sale of debt to households, that households began to exert a voice in the governance of these countries, including women's suffrage, that emerged after the First World War. And similarly, and further after the Second World War, certainly in the United States, it's not an accident that social democracy emerged because the debt of these countries was held, the victor countries was held by their own publics. They had a stake in it. So we ought to be integrating the financial and the political in a way which provides us with the leverage to make a difference, to really change the course of history going forward. Thank you very much.